Welcome to Midori House. We're live from Studio One here at Monocle 24. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be asking if Joachim Gauck is the right man to take over the German presidency.
And he also is not only a candidate that all political parties more or less can agree on, but he also is the candidate that most German citizens seem to favour.
We'll be hearing from author Duncan Clark about Africa's complex past and promising future. We'll also continue our celebrations for Monocle's fifth birthday. Today we're focusing on the role of the correspondent. And finally, I'll be joined here in Studio One by Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound to rifle through issues 11 to 20 of Monocle to reminisce over our favourite Monocle stories from year two. All that plus some great music right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. Joachim Gauck has been hailed by the German press as the next nominee for Germany's presidency after the resignation of Christian Wulff. The 72-year-old Gauck is regarded as a moral authority compared to 42-year-old Mr. Wulff, who stands accused of accepting favours from entrepreneurs and attempting to muzzle the press. Opinion is divided over the repercussions for Chancellor Angela Merkel after she backed Mr. Wulff over Mr. Gauck in the previous presidential contest in 2010. So what does this mean now for Germany, and what is the public's opinion of Gauck? Earlier, Christian Yeo caught up with Monocle's contributing editor, Marcus Albers, in Berlin, and started by asking, is he the right man for the job?
Yes, he definitely is, because he's a non-partisan candidate, and he also is not only a candidate that all political parties more or less can agree on, but he also is the candidate that most German citizens seem to favour. If you look at the polls, Joachim Gauck has always been leading the polls.
What do you think the German people now expect of Gauck? What issues are facing Germany, and what kind of president do you think he'd be?
Well, I think they really hope that he inspires some kind of, you know, moral integrity, something that the German president should have in the first place, because his job is a, you know, largely ceremonial one. He has no legislative powers. But the problem with his predecessor, Christian Wulff, was that there were all these scandals surrounding him. Probably nothing illegal, but it all didn't look very well. You know, things having to do with a loan for his house, with him being invited on holidays from business people, etc. So I think what the German people now want is a president who is just a person of integrity, and Gauck is that.
He's certainly more mature in terms of years. He's 72. Is he seen as a safer pair of hands?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, he's a Protestant pastor. He has been a human rights activist in East Germany. Everybody seems to agree that he is, he's very an integral person, absolutely. That's for sure. He's also a great orator, you know, being a pastor. He can give a speech like not many can, which also is important for a president because, as I said, it's largely a ceremonial role, so it helps that he's a great orator.
It's not his first time running for president. How were his chances thwarted back in 2010?
Well, that was interesting because Gauck then was positioned as a candidate by the opposition, actually, by the Social Democrats and the Green Party against Christian Wulff. And Merkel, Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, in 2010, not so long ago, pushed through her own candidate, Christian Wulff, against Gauck. And it was a close call, actually. Even then, many people, many citizens would have favored Gauck. But Angela Merkel insisted on pushing through her own candidate, Christian Wulff. As it turns out, it wasn't the wisest choice.
Although there's this idea of us versus them in this situation with Gauck versus Merkel, he's very much, some would say, cut from the same cloth as Merkel. Is this all a farcical opposition? Are they all very much part of the same ideology?
I mean, If you look at Gauck's history, you can consider him a conservative even, but he never was a member of any party. So he is non-partisan in the best sense, which is great for this job, actually. And I think the most important thing for Angela Merkel now was to actually come up with a solution that all political parties could agree on, and she had to come up with a solution quickly, and it had to work, because Christian Wolff, as you know, wasn't the first German president to step down. Before him, Horst Köhler stepped down just 2 years ago, and this is unheard of in German history even, two presidents stepping down in short succession. So Angela Merkel now had to find a solution, had to find it quick, and she managed this. So I think in the end, it all turned out well for her.
It certainly does. Having a conservative president, but one that's not associated with her party, would mean that she can't lose effectively. If he does badly, she can wash her hands of him as no connection to him whatsoever.
Yeah, she could do that, but I think everybody right now is interested in Gauck not failing. We cannot have a third president fail. This is just impossible. So Gauck, now everybody wants him to succeed. And the great thing also about Gauck is that he has an agenda. You know, in Germany, the German president, he always needs an agenda, but it has to be one that is not too closely connected to everyday political things. So Gauck's agenda always has been freedom. I mean, he has been, as I said, he's been a civil rights activist in East Germany. So his agenda being freedom, that's great, because this is something everybody can agree on. And at the same time, it's reasonably far away enough from everyday politics, so it doesn't affect things that Merkel would decide upon, you know, say, Greece, for example.
That was Monocle's contributing editor, Marcus Albers, in Berlin. You're listening to Midori House. We're back after this.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films, and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis, and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than The Curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly, and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience. Either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
With bureaus in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York and Zurich, and over 25 correspondents around the world, Monocle has an experienced team of editors and journalists filing for us around the clock. From our bureau in Hong Kong, Liv Lewichnik covers Southeast Asia.
From Hong Kong, I cover China, Malaysia, Singapore, the Philippines and other Asian nations. And I also do stories in Australia from time to time. In Harbin, northeast China, I visited moon robot builders and Siberian tigers. And I popped over to Penang to check out the property market in Georgetown, a place that has the feel of 1960s Singapore to it. I love working from Hong Kong. It's a regional hub for commerce and finance that is taking leaps and bounds on the international art scene. It's got some of the best restaurants and shops around, and being one of the easiest places to start a business, it's a hotspot for startups. It's a city in fast forward, which is just the way we like it.
That was Monocle's Liv Lewichnik, our woman in Hong Kong.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, as we discussed on last night's Monocle Daily, Africa's economies may be growing, but they still face severe problems. In his new book, Africa's Future, renowned oil expert and economist Duncan Clark claims that the continent's future relies on an understanding of its complex economic past. I spoke to him a little earlier and began by asking him to outline where he thinks Africa's economies stand right now.
Well, the sort of official forecast of growth coming from the Bretton Woods institutions, IMF, World Bank, and you can include here African Development Bank and Economic Commission for Africa, we're talking late last year about sort of 5% growth rate this year and going forward for 5 years or so. But they've had to back down those estimates of late. You've seen, obviously, some of the deterioration in the economies in the Maghreb and North Africa. Libya, with the consequences of conflict and the war, probably lost 50% of real GDP. to an enormous loss. Now, I know the oil game is coming back. It's not yet up to scratch as it was then, but the reconstruction damage and costs will be substantial. Tunisia, which is probably the most promising one in terms of the economics, is flatlining. Egypt is probably going negative. Now, these are big economies with a lot of history. And we have in South Africa slow growth. The IMF was just recently downgraded to 2.2%. And that might be because they're trying to sort of be optimistic. It might go worse depending on the euro and the trade relationships. South Sudan has put itself back on ground zero because they've basically shut down production in this conflict with Khartoum about the oil and the transit costs for oil. Kenya's slowing down. Nigeria's been doing relatively well, but they've got their own internal problems. You've got stasis in certain parts of Africa. I mean, I'm saying that the growth is not happening, West Sahara, etc. And, you know, you have troubled economies in Malawi and Swaziland and Lesotho. And there are lots of other sort of...
I mean, you're listing off quite a number of countries there where we're saying that there isn't really growth and the economies are struggling.
No, there is growth, but there are problems, and there are 55 states across Africa, effectively. So I'm saying that the growth rate is probably backing down a notch or two. And the futurologists in Africa are saying, well, this 5% real growth we project to 2050, and if that happens, well, the GDP would in Africa go from just under $2 trillion now to $14 trillion in 2050, meaning they would be of the size equivalents of EU and or United States, which would be a huge accomplishment.
But that's quite unlikely, though, isn't it?
Well, I think the only way to test that is to look at the empirical historic record, and that's what my book, Africa's Future, does. It goes back to the time when the Romans were in Carthage and tracks the economic data, GDP, income per head, going over the 2,000-odd years that have followed since then. And Africa went backwards for 19 centuries, and then it turned the corner. And the growth rate started to move up in GDP, in income per head, and the golden decade has been the last decade. But on the long-term cycle of 30, 40 years, Africa has not crossed a rate of success of 3.8.
Even if we look at the figures themselves, even if we believe the figures themselves, they can sometimes disguise the reality. You know, Equatorial Guinea, for example, has astonishing growth, but it's all fueled by oil, and all the profits are going to a very, very small group of people. And the vast majority of people in that country are still living on $1, $2 a day.
This is where I think one has to be careful, because this is the sort of conventional media Western narrative on Equatorial Guinea. The oil curse, the family dynasty, the growth out of oil and poverty, etc., etc. Now, that set of circumstances actually, in my diagnosis, is very different. Firstly, because it was a very poor country. The discovery of oil or resources has actually been a net plus for Equatorial Guinea in growth, in investment, in small but positive industrialization. And I'm not saying there isn't poverty. Mm. I'm saying there's been a change in the income and the structures. But, there's a lot of mythology and assumptions about the oil curse, about certain countries, about African politics, et cetera, that's often quickly outdated and not deep enough to really see what's really happening on the ground.
So, but you say these are mythologies, but I mean, to take Nigeria as an example, Nigeria is a country that should be one of the wealthiest in the world, and yet has been has really suffered from an oil curse.
No, there's no such thing as an oil curse. I know there's a theory in a literature, but it's misspecified and it's empirically testable in the negative. It's also analytically weak and flawed. What there is a curse of politics and politicians.
Yeah,
let's differentiate the resource base from the political architectures that sits upon it and squats over it and exploits it and doesn't use it for public investment and welfare growth and all the rest. So Africa is very rich in resources. It's not a poor continent. It's just poorly managed. And this is a case where a lot of improvement could take place, even in Nigeria. There's a reason why it's been called the land of no tomorrow, I think, and that's because, it's been heavily discounted. But there has been an upside in the growth rate. It's possible they could do a lot better, but there are a lot of fundamental challenges and pressures, and from demography, from population of around 160 million going through to 20, 45, 50, which will be 300 million. There will be growth of a lot of young cohorts in the age structure. And the question will be how much investment and growth takes place to provide jobs and income.
Well, I mean, that's the final thing I want to pick up on you, in that we're almost telling a positive story that's saying, you know, growth is improving and
it is.
And so on. And yet, as you just touched on there, there is this issue of demographics, in that you're having a lot of young and now actually quite well-educated people coming through who aren't getting jobs. If you look at a number of countries across Africa, they might be creating jobs, but they're not creating enough each year, even just to stand still, to give those to the ones that are coming into the labour market. Is this the continent's greatest challenge going forward?
I think it's one of them. And I think the investment matter is equally important, as, you know, because the underlying requirements for more investment, for opening up to get a maximal growth rate. You'll only get the maximal employment rate if you get the maximal growth rate. I think you can see this in the evidence of the most modern state in Africa, South Africa, whereby over some centuries now, you've got a highly sophisticated economy. You've got a sort of third world sitting, around it. And in 1977, when I was there, I did an economic evaluation on structural unemployment in Southern Africa with Charles Simpkins, a very well-known economist in the country, and we calculated the unemployment rate at 25% then. The rate today is still the same. So it raises another question. Is the model of South Africa's evolution a limit to what you might expect in other analog situations elsewhere in Africa? But don't confuse Africa with its 55 states, complexity and fragmentation as one market. It's not. And it will never be, to be honest. I think there's a lot of delusionary dreamtime activity in the political sphere where, you know, they're going to have an African monetary union, an African currency, an African trading regime, etc., etc., whereas what should be happening is these 55 states, and in the future there might be a few more, should focus on sorting their own problems out and not, if you like, combining their problems with delusionary strategies and ideas that look good at the African Union or to their political constituencies, but which are not going to yield any net positive results.
That was Duncan Clark, author of Africa's Future. Now it's time for some music, and just to prove how good Africa's Future is going to be, this is a band from Kenya, three guys from Nairobi. They're called Just a Band, because they are just a band, and this is the rather lovely Usini Bor.
Don't tell me what I can and can't do. I can change the world.
Usini Bo.
That was Usini Bo by Just a Band from Kenya. You're listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24.
LDN TYO NYC MT4.
In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be joined by Monocle Editor-in-Chief Tyler Brulé, Editor Andrew Tuck, and Culture Editor Robert Bound to discuss 5 years of Monocle. And we'll also have some of our favourite correspondents from around the world in the studio. But first, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Steve. Eurozone finance ministers have agreed a €130 billion rescue for Greece to avert an imminent chaotic default after forcing Athens to commit to unpopular cuts and private bondholders to take bigger losses. Syrian government forces killed 21 people and wounded some 340 today when they unleashed a heavy artillery barrage on a rebel-held district of the city of Homs. Iran would take preemptive action against its enemies if it felt its national interests were endangered. The deputy head of the Islamic Republic's armed forces was quoted by a semi-official news agency as saying today. Yemen has pushed Ali Abdullah Saleh from power after 33 years, voting to install his deputy as president with a mission to rescue the nation from poverty, chaos and the brink of civil war. About 2,000 Afghans protested outside the main US military base in Afghanistan today over a report that foreign soldiers improperly disposed of copies of the Holy Quran. Former IMF chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn was questioned by police today over his dealings with an alleged prostitution ring that was run from the northern French city of Lille and organised sex parties in Paris, Brussels and Washington. Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum has accused Democratic President Barack Obama's administration of implementing healthcare policies that discourage marriage and hurt families. And Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe turned 88 today, joking about reports circulating for years of his imminent demise, and vowed to stay in power despite international condemnation of his economic and human rights record. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. This is Midori House. And all this week on Midori House, we're looking back over the last 5 years of Monocle. A little bit later, I'll be joined by Tyler, Andrew and Rob to go through issues 11 to 20. But first, we're turning our attention to the life of the correspondent. When Monocle launched, we established fully staffed bureaus in New York and Tokyo and began to build a network of correspondents around the world, one of which was me in Nairobi. We now have just over 25 correspondents from Santiago to Stockholm, Bogota to Beirut, as well as an extra bureau in Hong Kong. And I am delighted to say that three of those correspondents are here with us in Studio One at Midori House. Sasha Eisenberg from Washington, D.C., Adam Labor, fresh off a plane from Budapest, and Ivan Carvalho, our man in Milan. That rhymed. Welcome, all three of you.
Thank you.
Let's start, Adam, with you. The life of the foreign correspondent, it sounds often very glamorous, and obviously working for Monocle, I'm sure it is, but is it really?
Sometimes it really can be. You can go off and do stories, you propose them to yourself or to Andrew or to Tyler. There's not many magazines that let you do that because you're given the time and the space and the pages in the magazine to really cover it as well as you can.
Sasha, when you go out on a job and you're away for 3 or 4, maybe 5 days to do a story, I mean, talk us through how it works, what the planning that you do beforehand, what it's like on the ground.
Well, stories are different, obviously, and there's some where there's a sort of natural narrative arc that I know going in, and so I have a character or set of characters that I want to stick with and sort of let my reporting branch out from them. And then there are other stories that are more place-based, which is a lot of the story types that we do, especially in the first couple sections of the magazine, where I try to set up as many meetings with people all over the place and don't really, I know some of the themes and questions I want to answer, but I don't really know what the architecture of the piece is going to look like, and I have to sort of let my reporting guide me, and then I want to leave my days sort of flexible enough that when I meet with somebody, I can always be asking, who else should I see while I'm here? And in the best cases, your sources are often people who will refer you to other good sources, and you have the freedom to sort of chase new ideas down those lanes and let the story sort of develop organically as you see it.
And Ivan, from your base in Milan, you don't just cover Italy, but often Switzerland and other parts of Europe as well. Do you find that depending on where it is you're going, there's a slightly different attitude to you as a correspondent?
I think so. In Italy, sometimes it's there's a lot of paperwork sometimes before we go out on assignment. I've been fortunate to cover several stories where I followed the Italian Coast Guard, the Italian tax police. And beforehand, there's a lot of work in Italy because it's a very bureaucratic country, getting requests and translating requests, asking London to send paperwork and letterheads over.
I remember writing a few of those letters. Yeah, there are certain cultures which can be slightly difficult for that, aren't there?
It could take once, I believe it was 3 to 4 weeks. And sometimes, for a magazine, sometimes a story appears out of nowhere and you need to turn around quickly. And in those cases, in Italy, it is difficult sometimes because of the bureaucratic process, because especially the military, because you're dealing with chains of command and a defense ministry. And then sometimes even the embassy of the country, in this case, the UK embassy, has to be your representative. So bit of a headache with the paperwork.
Indeed. In fact, the military, it's quite interesting when you look at lots of different countries at the same time. We ran a story in Alpino last year about the, in the end, it was about the German mountain troops. And Ivan, you were trying to get access to the Italian mountain troops.
Desperately.
For several weeks, we had no joy. Interesting is that the Germans, after 2 days, said, yep, fine, we can do it. They were very efficient. The Norwegians got back to us 2 weeks ago to say, we've given you clearance. It was about 4 months too late. But still, it was nice of them. It was nice of them to think that. Adam, you said, without bigging us up too much, obviously, when we go and do stories, we send a writer, we send a photographer, we cover all the costs, we pay for the flights. You're there to just do one story. You know, you've worked for other newspapers and magazines as well over the past 20 years from your base in Budapest. How have you seen the life of foreign correspondent change when we're talking about other places, other news organisations?
Well, without naming names, the main difference is, the first question is, how much is it going to cost?
Yeah.
If I wanted to go, say, to Slovakia for the day to do a story, which is just like a three-hour drive there and a three-hour drive back, that's always almost always the first question is, what's it going to cost? Because everyone is so budget conscious now. And it simply wasn't like that when I started out. When I started out and I was covering the wars in Yugoslavia, they just threw money at us, really, and rightly so, because we were in a very dangerous place and we needed to have plenty of cash in case we needed to get out quickly. But it's not like that anymore. And you're encouraged to take the cheapest flight, to stay, you know, in the cheapest hotels.
Take your own photos.
Sometimes take your own photos, yeah, which I think is wrong, because it's a different art to be a photographer. I don't want to be a photographer. I want to be a writer. I got a little SMS message from a friend of mine the other day who works for a major national newspaper. He was trying to do a story in Berlin, and the foreign editor asked him if he can sleep on someone's couch. And
right.
you can't really work like that. I mean, you can't work, you can't sleep properly, you can't get settled, you need a desk, you can't do your job if you're sleeping on someone's couch. So one of the great things about Monocle is, I feel that we're properly backed up and I don't have to worry about that stuff. Obviously, I don't go mad and order Bollinger and caviar and room service. But you
as
feel
a person
that,
who has to put through your expenses, yes.
Yeah. No,
exactly. But it's about not going too far.
Exactly, not going too far. But you feel that you can, you know, focus on the story.
And Sasha, you write a lot for a US audience as well in your other work. How do you find the difference between working for a US audience, writing for a US audience, and writing for an international audience like ours?
No, I mean, one of the great things about Monocle, I think, from the perspective of any nationality, but especially the US, where there is a great tradition of foreign coverage, but so much of it is filtered through a sort of an American lens and an idea of what does this mean for America, is to go out on a good story and not have to tell it to either satisfy the sort of understood curiosity of a particular constituency or some idea of what does this mean from, you know, if it's a political or business story, what does this mean strategically from one country's point of view? And, you know, I think about that. There are a lot of stories I've done for the magazine that have would have been a lot different if I'd been doing them for an American publication, because there would have been a set of questions that would have come in from the editor if I turned in the same type of story I did for Monocle. They would say, well, why does an American care about Curaçao status? There are good answers to that, but they would have been an entirely different story. And the things that drew me to that subject and place at the outset weren't those. And so I think that you get the sort of purity of subject and story in Monocle as a match, because things don't have to be filtered through a sort of set of national priorities.
Yeah, I'd like to say one of the other things I noticed with British newspapers in particular is that you have to come up with some kind of angle or line, especially to, as Sasha says, make it relevant for a British audience. So with Monocle, you don't do that because it's a monthly briefing. You go out and you find out what's going on and you report it. Obviously, it has to be newsy, it has to be topical and interesting, but you're not forced to kind of jam the story into a round peg when it's a square-shaped story.
Now, Adam, you mentioned some of your favourite stories earlier. Ivan, when you look back on the 4 years, almost 5 years? That you've been
five, working, number, I've, since for, issue one.
Since issue one, okay. Like me, a veteran. From issue one all the way through to issue 51, what are your particular highlights?
I'd have to say top of the list was last summer, with a German photographer. We were in Naples covering the Guardia di Finanza, the tax police, the guys that go and the ball busters that go out and chase the mafia, the Camorra in Naples. And we spent 4 days with them patrolling on the sea. We saw the air units they have, the helicopters, and then the various raids that they do for the counterfeit goods and drugs. That was just amazing, because we were able to get access inside the command center. And you see that you know, one of Italy's greatest problems, and still a problem today, of organized crime. And these people on the front line who were, the day we were there, some of their colleagues were actually shot by, received shots from the highway, and it's that story I think was probably the most impressive for me in terms of just meeting these individuals that have to basically risk their lives every day against clans that are well armed, in some cases better armed than the police.
Yeah, although the police looked fairly well armed as well. I mean, judging from the photos, it was a stunning story that ran in Monocle Mediterraneo. It was at Expo in that issue, and it has one of my favourite pictures as well from Expo, which is the four guys all in their white uniforms, all holding sort of weird sort of
the
submachine
cadets.
Guns.
These are the cadets
that looked like some strange sort of boy band, some Italian boy band in a video, all holding their guns in completely different directions, if they weren't quite sure what to do with them.
They weren't loaded though, because we visited the armory.
You're sure about that?
We visited the armory, and there was a big parade. They were having their anniversary parade in Naples, and we went to the armory, and in that armory, you could probably, there was enough weapons to probably overthrow Serbia, perhaps, or certainly Kosovo. And they all lined up, and all these young cadets in all their pearly white uniforms, and were given these submachine guns, these Berettas. There was a few shotguns in there, and so that was something. And then we got down to the shooting range. I and the photographer, we were able to even test out the shooting range, which I failed miserably. Yes, they have these old videos.
You didn't mention that at the time.
No, I left that out. They have these old videos from, it looks like police training videos from the 80s, like in the it's from the California Highway Patrol, I think. And so you're there with a gun. It's not a real. You have like a laser tag, and so you're trying to shoot the assailant or supposed assailant. And then at the end, they tell you whether you hit them or whether it was in a real threat or not. So,
okay, Sasha,
I haven't mentioned Kosovo, so I'll take that as a jumping off point to mention something that links two of us at the table. I went to Kosovo at, I believe, the end of 2009 to do a story for Monocle. Adam had been there, I believe, on the day of.
Yeah, that was another big story that I did. Yeah, and on the day of independence.
On the day of independence, yeah. and did a great piece on this moment where Kosovo declared their independence from Serbia. I came back almost 3 years later, and to do a story on how, despite declaring their independence, Kosovo still did not have a seat in the UN General Assembly, was recognized by very few international institutions because they had not gotten their sovereignty recognized by, I think at that time they were in the 60s was the number of countries. And it was a story that I had stumbled upon as Washington correspondent because I was looking through, as I tried to in search for story ideas, event listings from the various diplomatic institutions in town. And the what at the time was a Kosovo mission to the United States was having a party at some dismal third-tier business hotel in Washington to celebrate, I believe it was then the second anniversary of their independence in February of 2009. And there was some note as a gesture of thanks to the countries that had recognized their sovereignty. I had no idea that this was an issue. I had, like many people who read international newspapers, sort of assumed that I knew that there were still some lingering issues in Kosovo, but I had no idea that there was still an open question as to whether it was really a nation state. And so I ended up spending some time I don't think he had the title of ambassador, but the man that they had posted in Washington at the time. And it was this sort of amazing burden that had been placed on this young country, which is that they actually had to get a piece of paper signed and faxed from every foreign mission and foreign ministry in the world, testifying to their recognition as a country. And yet this is a small young country that barely has its own foreign ministry, let alone, you know, just the sheer manpower to work the phones and faxes to capitals all around the world. And so their guy in Washington was, because they could get to basically every embassy on earth there, their point of contact. And so I spent some time with him. I spent some time with the foreign minister when he came to town for the UN General Assembly that fall. And then a few months later went to Pristina and saw the foreign ministry and wrote a little bit about things that they were doing in the sort of public space to gain recognition for Kosovo as a country and its place in a new Europe. And it was a great example of Monocle being able to follow a story as it changed from different dimensions and Adam seeing it, you know, through his experience in Eastern Europe and me seeing this sort of play out in a far-flung capital on you know, on another end of the international stage, but the sort of continuous link between stories we've done. And after 5 years, I think there are probably many more examples of that.
I'm sure there are. And we're going to come on to those with Tyler and Andrew and Rob in a moment. But for now, Adam Labor, Sasha Eisenberg, Ivan Carvalho, three of our 25 correspondents. A list
three best,
growing.
I believe.
I can possibly say that.
Three
I know,
of the best.
I know you're in the room with
me
now.
We made some edits to the scripts.
The other 22 are listening. So
we say three of the best.
Three of the best. Three. No, we're quite happy to say three of the best. Monocle correspondents, Adam, Sasha, Ivan, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
Monocle Films, the cinematic eye on the world that brings you crafted stories from affairs to business, culture to design. Plus, our weekly Monocle briefings featuring original concepts in travel and retail. Premiering this week, high-performance innovation from the biggest sporting goods trade fair in the world.
There's a real nice vibe for almost what we're calling gentleman explorer. Those people who used to go to the Arctic in just a jumper and an extra pair of socks and that beautiful styling coming through. So, yeah, some really nice heritage product.
You can find this and over 400 more films on monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, and I've been joined in the studio by three gentlemen with magazines in front of them: Tyler Brûlé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck. Hello.
Hello. Hello. We're the old school, Steve.
Long on experience.
You are, yeah.
It's Steve Broomfield. Look at.
Long on experience, indeed.
The new Broomfield.
The new Broomfield. Yes. For those that weren't listening to yesterday's Midori House, firstly, why not? And secondly, you would have discovered that my name in the very first issue was spelled Steve Broomfield, not Bloomfield.
How long did it take you to notice that?
You know what? It wasn't until about a year ago. Right. I was flicking through the issue. I was like, hey, look, I was even on the first masthead. Look at that.
Oh. Were you terrified of him at the time, Andrew? Were you worried about that phone call from Nairobi?
I think there's so many other things going on in that issue. I probably didn't even notice myself for a year.
I probably thought
he was cool, Steve Broomfield. I didn't really take much notice of him.
To get the TEPEX out for the leaving
anyway.
Card, Steve.
I'm leaving? The party tonight is for me?
What happened with your first box of cards? That's what I want to know.
No, the first box of cards I got sent did say Steve Bloomfield, but it took me 7 hours to pick them up from Nairobi's post office, and I had to see 12 different people and pay 2 bribes, all for some Monocle business cards. When I opened them up, it was like, oh, is that why I've been sent? Right. Anyway, enough about that. We're talking about issues 11 to 20, volume 2 of Monocle. And I see not only do you have magazines in front of you, but you've got post-it notes.
So organised. You're surprised at how organised I am.
I'm not surprised. I'm slightly surprised, yeah. Go on then. Since you've been so organised, Rob, do you want to kick us off?
This is the expo. And we're starting at the back. We're going forwards.
We can do that.
I think we're allowed to jump around.
The expo from from issue 20 was about South Korean shipbuilding. And it was an amazing, beautifully shot story. Fiona, our Tokyo editor, wrote the story. But it's based in Busan, and it's just the most epic, huge... It sort of slightly reminds me of the beginning of Star Wars, where that spaceship goes over the screen. These humongous... And they're absolutely beautiful shots.
Yeah, also the quality of them. There's something, sort of the epic nature of them. There's something quite Gursky-esque about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're quite hard to place in time as well. When you look at that spread with that huge ship and the way that people are dressed, it could be the 50s or the 60s.
Yeah.
A great picture at the bottom of the guy in the raincoat walking through the shipyards. It's amazing.
Yeah, there's one. Isn't there one also in Busan town? There's a guy sort of walking through the neighborhood as well.
I think it's on that spread just before.
Where is it?
They're absolutely gargantuan, these kind of structures.
I lost it.
Yeah, they're
beautiful.
They truly are.
And they are sort of Gursky-esque. And I presume they are they're a great advert for shooting on film as well, aren't they? I mean, they're absolutely stunning.
And I remember the story that went with that too, because they went out for a big Korean seafood feast, of course, it being in Busan. I think one of the Korean shipbuilding companies, they took us up in a helicopter for that story. And the poor boy was just was having a bad time of it, almost at both ends.
Tailspin.
Yeah, exactly. Stay away from the sea urchin.
Andrew, you've got the same issue in front of you, but you're going to look at the front of it, aren't you?
Issue, because we should talk about the front cover. But I'm actually wondering if there was inspiration for the killing from this, because it could be Sara Lund. A blonde version of the Icelander, which
she's got whiter hair.
She's got the Faroese sweater on the front.
She's got the right knitwear, right hair. But I also do like that the story that we did for that, which was Amory Gardner. We sent her up to Iceland, and a story we covered a few times. We went there after the banking collapse, and we followed the country quite carefully as it kind of went back to its roots in a way. And I think it was a great piece that Amory did, and she kind of just met all these people who kind of once gone to French restaurants who were now going back to Icelandic restaurants. They'd kind of ditched the big cars and they were trying to find something a bit more genuine. And it's an interesting lesson, I think, actually, for lots of other countries now. That's, you know, for Greece, for all these places. You know, how do you go back to your roots when you can't rely on big loans and cash and banking? And it was a really touching story.
I mean, Anne-Marie's had some great assignments. This is the April 2008 issue that I'm looking at. That we sent her to Atlanta to the Bronner Brothers hair fair, which is just an Afro-American weave fair.
And they are some quite impressive weaves.
Oral Gardner, she's made it to some interesting places.
And she's mainly needed a puffer jacket with her.
Always.
it does tend to be somewhere cold.
Yeah, we've kind of noticed that the temperature's very cold. We send Anne-Marie Gardner.
Or we send her on a boat. But we'll come to that one later in the week. When she spent
now, we didn't send
her
on this story, but actually the March 2008 issue, which was issue 11, John Balsam went to shoot up in on the Russian-Finland border with us, with Elna Nykänen and Anderson, our correspondent. And it was kind of a bit of a diversion, don't you think, for the photography? There was something about it that was, it was reportage, but because John Balsam has a kind of background in kind of fashion photography as well, there's something amazingly cool about the troops that control this border.
It also, is looking at this is the May issue. Is that what do you have there? That was the
March.
That was March. But also, we sent John Balsam up to speaking of Sarah Lynn Sweater, to the Faroe Islands as well, and he did this piece up in Torshavn. And I just love this wonderful picture of. Well, it just says a woman dressed for her hen night, but actually she looks like sort of a regular resident. I would sort of hope that I would see women dressed like that up in the Faroe Islands.
I love that. It doesn't look very hen.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't, no.
They've got a pleasing lack of L plates and, you know, like, whatever. And
I know what you mean. Rob, what have you got in front of you?
I've hit fast forward. I've gone to issue 18. This is November 2008. And this was a culture lead story, actually, that was beautifully illustrated, and it was about the people that make the people behind the scenes.
Do you edit that section?
Yes. But yeah, it was a kind of joy to put together this thing. It was mostly written by our US team, actually, and it was about the US elections. But it was about the media war that's waged rather than the political parties. So it sort of took everything to bits, and we kind of did a lot of research on the sort of new tech that was going to be cropping up, sort of behind the scenes in the TV studios. What kind of kit the reporters needed, and some of the stars of the shows as commentators. Ariana Huffington's This World.
I have a feeling you're going to be recommissioning that story in about 2 months' time, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was just glad I pulled that one out. That's easy.
Excellent, good. Culture Leave for November issue sorted. Excellent, good.
And then I think another story I really like is May 2008, the Expo, which is for Beirut, and mainly a story about Ashrafia, the Christian neighbourhood. And I think it's one of the great things about actually being at Monocle is how you get to know certain places around the world quite well. And we've done a lot of reporting out of Beirut. We have an amazing correspondent there. So wonderfully, I've been 2 or 3 times via Monocle there. And it's great just looking at the pictures, because actually the people in those pictures who we didn't know that well at the time...
They're all friends of the family. They're all coming to the party tonight.
Yeah, we seem to know them all very well. And just an amazing, York Koopman who shot it, it's just a glorious, the architecture is incredible, the portraits are beautiful, and there's something faded and charming and wonderful.
And it's funny, this is the there's an image here, I think it's an opal, this sort of baby blue opal with this wonderful aquamarine pillar. It's just a fantastic building. So I asked York Koopman for this print, and this print is hanging in my bedroom. It then ended up, with our love affair of the city, they ended up taking an apartment in that very building.
It's absolutely gorgeous there. Yeah. There's a proper smoky kind of... There's something smoky about that.
It is.
Something nostalgic about that type of
thing. And we're hoping to get Mr. Robert Baum back there this summer.
Can't wait.
To Beirut?
For the festival.
For the Hay Festival, that's
yes,
right.
Yes, indeed.
Any other final little thoughts?
Yeah, I have one more,
You've got
actually.
One more, I can see.
I think in issue 20, it was not just a good cover. There was a really nice fashion story in here called Pelican Briefs. Yeah. Okay. I don't know who had their pun hat on. I don't know whether Mr. Brulé or Mr. Tuck had their pun hat on for them.
That's got Tuck.
That's clearly a Tuck.
And I'll use this as a euphemism, but I think the model has some very good fashion. She's pretty. She's got some good fashion going on.
Yeah, what page is Pelican Briefs?
135, Steve.
135.
You can tell the page there. And the other one I like is also in issue 16, which was September that year, we did a piece about the world's best lift companies, which we called "You Lift Me Up." But I was always very disappointed because one of the lift companies was called Schindler, and I wanted to call it Schindler's Lifts.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
That's,
I know.
Is when you want every single company to have a little mini headline, isn't it? Yeah, now we right. know why. You think it's a needless page.
What you don't know is I sometimes work from the headline. I find a good pun, and I just commission the story around
exactly.
it. I thought Schindler's Lift would be good. Let's commission a story about that.
I do know that's how you work. That's the problem.
And actually, if you like,
go
on. Sumo. I think this must be one of the most beautiful, beautiful stories we did. It was by Alexis Armanet, who again is a photographer out of Paris who does a lot of work with fashion. But we've made it a bit of a tradition of getting people who are photographers in one genre to shoot something quite different. And he went and shot the world of sumo. And the portraits are just extraordinary. And it's
I think it contains an unsettling picture of a man, a sumo wrestler, training with a skipping rope.
Oh, there's a lot of
jiggle, I think.
Yeah, it's an absolutely brilliant picture.
It's unbelievable a man that big could skip, isn't it?
But there he is.
Is that the caption?
When you look back on these issues, on this volume, are there things that you notice there that have changed from how we do things now? Or is it sort of more of a steady evolution?
I think it's just the density of the book. Yeah. It gets every year. There's more and more. You know, there's more in there. It's more detailed. It's more referenced. And I thank God we've done it in steps, because actually, when you look back and you think that would seem to be tough back then, but now the amount of information that's in Monocle is amazing. Mm. But I think that's the thing. It's just, you know, how much it looks a little bit quieter there.
I think if you look at the July August issue from Volume 2. And this is it's a story on building brands, and it's just looking at sort of the relations between, famous brands and how they're sort of related to their home countries. We would never run flags that big anymore. It just seems like filler in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, also you look at the briefing pages. I'm looking at issue 18 here, and on the Asia page, we've got three stories. Now they're all good stories, but now we'd be looking at 5, 6. Plus an infographic.
That's why we hired you.
to fill them all.
And lastly, I think just when you look at the page for who works here, actually by issue, this is 10 issues in, so it's beginning to fill up.
We shouldn't call it Mass Day, we should call it Who Works Here.
Who Works Here. Works Here page. Suddenly there's a few people, but my gosh, you know, we've now moved to two pages.
I know, April issue we moved to two masthead pages.
Yeah, I know, it's mega. All because of people like Steve. It's true, isn't it?
Really?
Our foreign editor, Phil Space.
You'll blame it all on me. Okay, well anyway, on that note, thank you Tyler, thank you Rob, thank you Andrew.
I got to slip into my suit.
You have?
Yes.
The party's about to start. But you'll be back here tomorrow. For volume 3.
Same place, same time, same studio, hopefully.
Indeed. Yeah, no, it'll be the same studio.
Okay,
it'll be
good.
Different host, though.
That's the sound of the magazines.
That is the sound of the magazines. That was just three magazines being dropped. Anyway, but for now, that is everything for this Tuesday edition of Midori House. The show was produced by Dawn Trump. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Andrew Carter, although I think there was a little bit of Dawn Trump doing the studio managing as well. There always was. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 hours London time. The second part of our Greece series is going to be on then. Daniel Giacopelli is interviewing the mayor of Athens. Next on Monocle 24 is The Entrepreneurs with Jonathan Openshaw. Stay tuned for that. This has been Midori House. To play us out, because we are going to a swinging party, this is Swinging Party by Kindness. Goodbye.